It's Playback Daily from Monday, the 12th of April.
Spent most of my time looking to see if I was looking at a bee's belly or a back, because if I was looking at the back, the bee had gone into the wrong side of the veil.
You don't want to die, you just don't want to continue living the way you're living now.
Yeah. You know, every child with a pony grows up thinking about the Grand National. It was the first race that captured my imagination as a child.
I'm Gemma Craddock. Let's dive right in. What a weekend for Irish women in sport. Ireland began their Six Nations campaign with a crushing defeat of Wales in Cardiff. While in Aintree, well, let's have a listen.
They head towards the elbow with over a furlong to cover in the National, but it's Rachel Blackmore and Manella Times who are out four lengths clear of Balco de Flo, and any second now, Burrows Saint back in fourth is running on empty. 150 yards to go in the National. Manella Times for JP McManus, Henry de Bromhead, and more significantly, Rachel Blackmore. History in the National. Manella Times wins.
Rachel Blackmore, a history maker once again, the first woman to win the 173-year-old Grand National at Aintree. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning, Audrey. I don't think I'll ever get tired of hearing the clip of that race anyway.
That is for sure. You won on the back of Manella Times. Immediately after that race, you said you didn't feel male or female. I don't even feel human, you said. Has it sunk in yet?
No, I don't think it has. I don't know if it will for a while. it's just incredible. It really is.
You won the world's greatest and most famous horse race. How did that feel on Saturday?
Just incredible. You know, everyone grows up, you know, every child with a pony grows up thinking about the Grand National. It was the first race that captured my imagination as a child. You dream about it, but, you know, you dream about riding in the race and to actually go and win it, it just takes it to a whole new level. So it was just an incredible feeling. I don't know if my English vocabulary even, you know, has the words to describe it.
Well, look, let's talk about that last stage of the race, because at the third last fence, I think, Jet was seven lengths ahead, which is a good distance to be in front. At what point did you decide it's time to go?
Yeah, I suppose I was hoping that Jet would come back to us, and thankfully he did. And when he was coming back just on the turn in, my horse kind of grabbed the bit again and was happy to go forward. But it is a very long run in from the back of the last in Aintree, so you are trying to just save a little bit and you know, not fully commit until you get to the rail and you know, the winning line is in sight then.
And will you describe that feeling of knowing that victory is yours?
Yeah, so I was able to hear the commentator say, just as we came back onto the race course properly, I was able to hear him say that I was four lengths in front, and you know, I knew my horse was going to keep galloping to the line, and you kind of start believing it then, and it's just absolute elation. It really is. Like, it's just so massive. It's such a special race. You know, just to even be part of that race, I finished 10th in it last year, and I got a kick out of that. And you know, there's no other race that you'll finish placed in and get a buzz off it. But you know, the Grand National, that's why it's so special, because you know that happens. So to actually go and win it, it's indescribable, really.
Well, that's it. I mean, you looked like you were even more excited than you were after all your amazing wins at Cheltenham. Was that the case?
Yeah, I suppose Cheltenham, you know, my first feeling when winning in Cheltenham is of more relief, I think, because Cheltenham has a lot more pressure attached to it. Whereas, you know, you don't feel the same pressure going into the Grand National. You know, people don't have the same expectation because, you know, there's 40 horses, 4+ miles, you know, anything can happen. So, you know, you need so much luck in a race like that. You know, you need so much to go your way. So, yeah, it's just, you know, you don't have that pressure going in, so you don't have that instinct of relief when you cross the line.
Would you have heard the commentator saying you were four lengths ahead had the crowd been there?
No, I don't think, no, you wouldn't have. Definitely not. So, the one very small slight advantage to the unfortunate of having no crowds.
Yeah, exactly. Tell me, why did you pick Manila Times to ride? Was your decision influenced in any way by what happened in the Gold Cup, Aplutard coming in second to Manila and Indo?
So they both originated from John Nallan's runs a very successful point-to-point yard. So he sourced both horses, but no, their names are all that would have attached them. The prefix of their name, I suppose. Look, Henry de Bromhead had three runners in the race, and I had ridden Manila Times on two previous occasions, and was very lucky that the JP McManus's family were happy for me to ride him again. I was just thrilled to ride him, and it was brilliant when it all worked out.
Well, it was absolutely incredible all round because Ireland's horses took 10 of the first 11 finishing positions. That is remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it's phenomenal. There's a lot of good horses and a lot of good trainers over here. And you'd be delighted you're on this side of the sea anyway.
And you are the best jockey in the world right now. That is what everyone is saying. No one's arguing. You are winning the biggest races on the best horses. How does all of that sit with you, Rachel?
Look, I just feel extremely lucky. You can be the best jockey, but you're not going to win any races unless you have the ammunition under you. Very lucky to be associated with some very good trainers. Henry de Bromhead is, exceptional. His achievements this year, they're just incredible. To win the three big races in Cheltenham and then to win the Grand National and have the second in the Grand National in Ballycote Flow as well. Like, it's really just phenomenal stuff. And I'm just delighted to be part of everything down there and part of the team. And, you're in a position to be getting rides on horses of that calibre,
Yeah, but you are a huge part of it. We heard from Aidan O'Brien on the sports news earlier on. He talked about you being hungry, intelligent. You ride the horse rather than the race.
Yeah, look, it's as I say, when you're riding something that has, the ability to not make you panic, it's just a fantastic feeling, and it's a position a lot of jockeys would love to be in.
So what's next for you? Is the season almost over? I think, is Punchestown the last big festival?
Yeah, we've Punchestown at the end of the month, and that is the end of this season. But in the world of jumps racing, the next season kicks off straight away a couple of days later. So that is the world of jumps racing. So we have a small break at the end of June. I think there's maybe 12 days there at the end of June. So we'll take a bit of a break then.
Right. So how will you mark your success? How will you celebrate it?
Oh, we'll have to celebrate it properly when the world is back to normal. I think we'll have to mark it with a bit of a party.
Rachel Blackmore speaking to Audrey Carville on Morning Ireland. And there are plenty of people marking another special occasion today. The phased easing of COVID restrictions means a return to school for all second level students and the end to the 5 kilometre travel limit. On the news at 1, Theresa Mannion spoke to students at St Flannan's College in Ennis, County Clare, about their return to in-person teaching.
I'm really happy to be back. I feel, we've got it. It's much easier to learn in an environment. Some people don't have the resources at home, and in school you're kind of hands-on with the teachers. It's much more easier to focus in class, to see your friends, to have some bit of normality.
Yeah, it's a lot healthier than sitting at home, and most people don't come out of the house because they have COVID. They're afraid of it, and you sitting at a computer on Teams all day, you kind of get sick of it, and you prefer meeting your friends in school and getting to walk around air, and especially out in the fields, getting air and just meeting up with people mostly.
We came back for the first time and we're playing kick soccer and badminton in our PE hall.
What's that like?
It's kind of different because usually I'm staying inside because Corona and stuff and online school, but now we're back. And we're going to be working again, so it's awesome.
I'm delighted for the kids to be going back to school. I think it's been a very hard time for them and very challenging. The online learning has been managed very well in the school, but there's nothing like being with your friends in class, hanging out at the alleys, playing hurling and flannins. So we're delighted to see the children back in school.
This is the Hearty Cup. Sure, it's been flannins now 22 times. When you come into the school, sure, you're mostly thinking about hurling. Like, well, that's for us anyway. And you're always just looking forward to playing the Hearty Cup team.
It's been difficult, yeah, especially with online learning and stuff. And especially when we had sport, you could kind of had something to take your mind off the books and stuff. So now it's all focused on the studies and stuff at the minute. So hopefully now we get back in a few weeks playing the sport and stuff.
Some of the first to fifth year students returning to St. Flannan's in Ennis today. Well, our Cork-based reporter Jenny O'Sullivan was in Youghal earlier, chatting to people who've been able to travel beyond 5K for the first time since December the 30th.
Yeah, it's great to be out. It's like freedom.
Yeah, it's great to get out and look, see the sea again.
Yeah, we've missed the sea. We love the sea.
I think the majority of people have been following the guidelines, and I think so today is a good day for just to have that bit of extra freedom and just to be able to just get away.
We brought the flask and all, so happy days. Yeah. The tato sandwiches.
Well, you used to always come down in the summertime down to the beach and things like that, like, you know, but, you know, it's just nice to come down for a walk change because you can see the same place all the time going around, you know. But you'd always love to come out.
And did you feel yourself different. Excited?
Yeah, I did, because it's a lovely morning as well, and we said we've chance. We'll be going today now for a change. We might go somewhere else now again tomorrow, maybe, like, yeah. And the weather's supposed to be nice, so hopefully it will turn out all right. And all the children in the school, it'll be quieter.
It's been a tough couple of months, hasn't it?
Oh, sure, it's hard on everyone, really. And it's nice to see them all back in school again now, and hopefully it will be okay.
From Glanmire.
Is that far from here?
It's probably about a 25-30 minute drive, depending on the traffic. So it's worth all of the time. It's, you know, it's well outside of the 5 kilometres, but it's great to get back out into the fresh air again, so it's really, really good.
You know, I think there's a weight lift off a lot of people's shoulders to say that you can get into your car and go without worrying, you know, so thank God that's lifted.
Not having the fear of being stopped at a checkpoint as well and trying to explain yourself why you're going out for some fresh air or something like that, so it's really good.
Yeah,
it's freedom again.
We're from Youghal. I live in Youghal all my life. And we really only see each other passing, or we haven't been in each other's gardens or anything. So we might call to the wall.
And this is our first
day out.
Treat on the beach. It's a little cold, but we've parked to block the wind. And we've become best friends since COVID. We're in a group, and we check each other morning and night. Yeah.
We're so lucky in Youghal. We're so lucky.
The relief.
We walk here every morning.
And today to get out. It's just been
amazing.
But
you know we can do is that we're not breaking rules, because I'm of a vulnerable age, and it was very hard, actually. Very hard.
Jenny O'Sullivan chatting to visitors to a chilly Youghal beach this morning, as heard on the news at 1. Now my palms are sweaty at the thought of how many bad puns I could make with this next item, but for both our sakes I'm going to beehive. So ashamed. Bees play a vital role in our ecosystem. So if you've ever wondered what you could do to boost our insect population, or if you've ever considered beekeeping, Claire Byrne had the piece for you. She was joined by two members of the Irish Beekeepers Association, Stephen Gallagher and Colette O'Connell, who explained how they got involved.
Well, I had my grandparents and family interested and had kept bees for a long time. And down here in West Waterford, I was blessed. We had some great people, mentors. I'm into the environment. So, yeah, natural. It just happened naturally.
And how many hives did you start off with?
I started off with what we call two nukes, and they're literally a half a hive. And I actually grew my experience as the hives grew, as the nukes grew into full hives.
And did you know what you were doing when you started off?
Not at all. Not at all. Right. But as I said, I was blessed. We had some of the greats down here in West Waterford, like we had Claire Chabas, Martin Kern, the Taylors and Capoquin. So we learned and we laughed as we learned, which was brilliant.
And Stephen is with us now. Good morning, Stephen.
How are you doing, Claire? Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Delighted to talk to you. So when and why did you get involved in beekeeping?
I got involved in 2013. My partner Abigail was making skin cream, kind of experimenting and went looking to buy beeswax and couldn't find it online and ended up doing a course and found out it was easier to become a beekeeper to supply beeswax than buy it. That was pretty much it.
And did you? I mean, you got involved then through necessity, really, or trying to solve a problem. And then, did you find then that you enjoy it, and that's why you stuck with it?
Beekeeping is fascinating. So once you get hooked, you're kind of screwed. Like it's ridiculously fascinating. So,
what is it about it? Tell us.
It's constantly fascinating. So like. You think you understand something and then you realise you only know 1%. So the kind of the want to learn more is the bit that keeps you going, I think. But you never stop learning from the looks of it.
Is that the same for you, Colette?
Yes. The more you find out, the more you find out you don't know. And there's a never-ending wealth of knowledge to be got there. And we always say that bees don't read the books. So bees, keepers are kept on their toes constantly. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing like the thrill of that.
Do you get stung much? I would say everyone asks you that.
Well, as a beginner, you will. But as you become more competent, you become more gentle in your movements. And the bees don't like being vibrated. They don't want to sting you because a honeybee will die if it stings you.
Mm-hmm. So that's not their primary aim. It's only if they have to.
If they have to.
And when you started off, Colette, did you have all the gear?
I joined my local association and, as I said, I was mentored by them. We started off in the 90s with, when I first started looking about it, with a white boiler suit and a hat with a veil. And I spent most of my time looking to see if I was looking at a bee's belly or a back, because if I was looking at the back, the bee had gone into the wrong side of the veil. So nowadays we're much more bee-proofed in our suits, and we're better at handling them, so we don't have the same. We can focus more on what's inside the hive.
And Stephen, what about you? Are you big into having all the gear and, you know, making sure that you're protected?
I'm of the opinion where I don't listen to rules, and they say never wear black, so I wear black. And I want to learn why you don't wear black. And then you realise that you don't wear black because on a hot day you're cooked. So that's why you don't wear black. With the idea is, or the way it was told, was you don't wear black because you look like a bear and the bees don't like bears because they steal their honey. But I'm pretty sure the idea is that you just cook in the summer.
So do you get stung then much if you're not paying much attention to having the safety gear?
Not really. Like, the way Colette's explaining it, it's very gentle. It's meditative. So you do slow movements and you don't disturb them. They'll be a lot happier with you than if you were rough and abrupt.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, a bee sting isn't nearly as bad as a wasp sting, is it?
In my opinion, no. A wasp sting is much more painful.
Uh-huh. Tell me about the difference, Colette, between bees and wasps.
Well, as I said, a honeybee will die if it stings you. A wasp can regenerate their sting within 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people don't like wasps. I didn't like them last summer because they gave my bees a tough time. But they have a role in the environment as well. So, you know, we have to be aware.
What do you mean they gave the bees a tough time?
They were very strong last summer, and it wasn't a good summer for the honeybees, so they were weak, and so a lot of weak colonies would have been attacked by the wasps and would have died out.
Oh, they attack them, do they?
They will, you see, because in the summer when they're starting to build their nests, they need a lot of bee bodies and stuff. So they will actually take the bees and feed their young brood with the protein from the bees' bodies.
Right.
Nature can be tough, but at the same time, wasps are a gardener's friend and they will eat a lot of the garden pests that we don't like as well. So they have a role in nature too.
Stephen, do you agree with that? Are wasps the enemy or are they friends?
They're friends. Yeah, they're friends, definitely.
Yeah, they're not enemies of the bees, are they?
They can be. Yeah, at the end of the summer, they see wasps are kind of like they're the meat eaters of the insect, and the bee is like the vegetarian. So the wasp feeds, as Colette's saying, they feed on aphids and stuff during the summer, but then at the end of the summer, the aphids disappear. They start to starve.
Mm-hmm.
And then they predate on the honeybees.
Wow. Colette, when you're dealing with stings, I know you have some advice for people on how best to treat them.
What we suggest is that you actually scrape, if it's a honeybee sting, you scrape the sting out of your skin to the side. Use your fingernail or a knife or a hive tool, whatever. If you're beekeeping, what we recommend is you put a puff of smoke on it straight away to stop the pheromone alerting the other bees to come and attack at the sting site, because stings have a pheromone and it's calling the other bees come attack here. So, yeah.
I'm terrified now that you get stung once and they all swarm.
No. They come to this. It's their defence mechanism. But a rub of garlic on a bee sting works wonders. Bread soda paste for wasp stings. We recommend vinegar. It counteracts the pH of the sting. You know. But listen, I mean, beekeeping, don't be terrified. Bees don't, as I said, don't want to sting you. They'll actually let a noise off if you're being too rough and tell you kind of, you go be a little bit more gentle.
It's about how we behave around them.
It's how
really.
We behave. And I was telling Rachel, your assistant there, if you'd ever like to come and see the inside of the hive, we give you the gear. There's loads of IBA associations dotted around the country, and they'll all be delighted to have you and your team down to look inside the hive.
We better call Rachel, the producer. I don't have assistants.
I'm so sorry, Rachel. My apologies.
Don't worry at all. Listen, Stephen, I want to talk to you about swarms.ie. What is swarms.ie?
It is 999 for bees. So it's an all-island help network for swarms and bees. And it's made up of 605 volunteer beekeepers across the country at the minute. And how it works is the public alert, the website, myself, and then I report to or find the nearest beekeeper, and they come as quick as they can and they collect the bees when they're easy. So on a branch, when they swarmed, and when they're a big ball of bees. And then the beekeeper brings them home and keeps them alive.
And that is possible to do that. It is possible to move them, keep them alive and reinstall them.
Very, very, yeah. Depending on where they are. So like if they're on a low hanging branch, it's a very easy job. If they're in your chimney, it's a really hard job. Mm-hmm. So we try to prevent them before they get into your chimney.
And is this why you invented the bee hoover?
Yeah, so I got an offer. Like the swarms of the E idea was to just get the easy handy bees, which are swarms. But then a lot of people were contacting to say there's bees living in the roof for 3 or 4 years and they need to be removed and you need tools for that. So the hoover kind of came from there, the vacuum came from that.
Okay, and that does that save the bees as well?
Yeah, it safely takes them out of the roof because if you don't have a hoover, it makes the job, or if you don't have a vacuum, it makes the job really, really difficult because they crawl into the dark as you try and take them out. So you need to kind of pull them out first.
Okay, so the trick is to catch the bees before they go into your house. I mean, is it possible to do that? I'm sure they would prefer to have their hive in a garden rather than in a roof, would they?
So in nature, they do usually go for a hollow tree. But because their ecology is changing, the options for where they'd naturally go are disappearing, and the next best place seems to be our roofs. So that's basically what's happened over the last couple of decades.
Well, Colette, that takes me to a really important point, and you want to encourage people to leave a place in their garden, at least a small area, a wilded area, where they can happily live.
Yes, lots of people approach the Irish Beekeepers Association looking to take up beekeeping because they want to help the bees. But what they don't realise is there's lots of solitary and other pollinating insects that need our help, and they're every bit as much as important as honeybees for pollinating our flowers and crops. So if people want to go on pollinators.ie, there's lots of tips there for councils, churches, schools, urban gardens, farmers. Little ways that we can all play our part to help all pollinating insects. If you look around the countryside at the moment, dandelions are profuse and they're a very, very important source of food for bees that are waking up out of the winter slumber.
Colette O'Connell and Stephen Gallagher from the Irish Beekeepers Association on Today with Claire Byrne. And the websites mentioned there were irishbeekeepersassociation.com and pollinators.ie. And from bees to the celebrity ecosystem, as Ryan's guest this morning called it. Diane Negra is Professor of Film Studies and Screen Culture at UCD. And she explained how for every Matt Damon and his bag of cans, there's 100 influencers on exotic islands bemoaning their tough COVID experience. As Diane calls it, a crisis of relatability.
Well, I think COVID has had an unexpected event on the sort of effect on the celebrity ecosystem, which is to say, it hasn't been good for celebrities, if I can put it in that kind of blunt way. And what's really notable is that we haven't seen the emergence of pro-social forms of celebrity. And in the past, crisis moments, crisis periods, have tended to be kind of good for celebrity. You alluded to World War II. You could think about Vietnam, even 9/11 in a certain way, kind of had that effect. But in the pandemic, it's proven very difficult for celebrities to connect with people. And there's been a kind of crisis of relatability, I think.
Brilliant. Everything you've just said makes great sense. So let's break it all down. I should say that you're the professor of film studies in UCD. So that gives us a bit of context in terms of why you're talking about Hollywood among and celebrities, broadly speaking. But you mentioned World War II, you mentioned Vietnam, and I mentioned James Stewart. We could talk about Jane Fonda, and in terms of a celebrity taking a stance on a big issue of the day. Did people in those circumstances welcome the celebrity endorsement or denial of a certain view?
Right. Well, I think certainly in previous decades, there was a sense that part of what a kind of classical Hollywood celebrity was supposed to do was to sort of be pro-social, is to be seen and to be involved in charitable endeavors, things of that sort. There's a long history of this going on. But early in the pandemic, when Gal Gadot tried to do a video of this Imagine piece, it turned into a fail video and people rejected it. You know, so I think there's a sense that we no longer look to celebrities to function that way, that something's changed in the emotional economy around them, and that admiration has receded, that we don't look to celebrities in that same way as above us. In other words, we don't see them so much as talent displaying as profit seeking. We've come down to a financial level.
Right. And that's a great word, because the COVID experience for a lot of people has been a leveler. Not everyone. I mean, as they say, the same waters, different crafts. But when you think of the Gal Gadot, which became within probably minutes something that was sneered at and scoffed at, even though I don't think there was any badness in what she was trying to achieve, is there a cynicism that comes with, say, online reaction versus reaction previous to the online phenomenon?
Oh, I think so. I think one of the things that we've seen in the last year or so is how dependent the star system still is on Hollywood to deliver us certain kinds of products that we recognize that fit into generic modes and that then kind of unspool a very familiar process of publicity. But that notion of old Hollywood is really on the wane now. And I'm thinking about, one of the last big successes of that kind before the pandemic was, of course, Bradley Cooper's revival of A Star is Born. And you probably remember this kind of electrifying moment at the Oscars when he and Lady Gaga get up and perform, the song from that film. And it's this just fascinating thing. People rose to their feet. They were still applauding on the ad break. And those moments of a kind of older, glamorous, remote, talent-centered celebrity seem to be fading in favor of influencer culture and other more mundane modes of celebrity.
So can we try and, in your research or your studies of it all, and it's all because COVID's still a fluent story.
Yeah.
Have you discovered, Diane, in any sense, what happened to people? Why did they suddenly go, once upon a time, you were lionized and elevated? Who kicked the plinth from under them?
Yeah. Well, I certainly think that the rise of reality TV about 20 or 30 years ago has been a significant milestone. I think that we've also seen a massive rise in tabloid culture, paparazzism. There's been a turn just lately in popular culture toward revisiting the 90s with a sense of horror, for example, looking at how young female celebrities were treated in those years. So my sense is that we've had a couple of different technological generic evolutions, if you want to call them that, tabloidism, paparazzism, and reality TV. But then it's really social media, because social media thrives on the idea that we are all sort of curating ourselves to be celebrities, that this kind of sense that celebrity isn't a remote, far-off thing, and it isn't something for which you pay your dues over many years. When you think about what the Hollywood studios used to do, how they used to groom star properties over a long period of time, the idea of instant celebrity and a celebrity that's based on our desire to be famous seems to now be at the center of things.
So what do we do with compare and contrast, to use the Leaving Cert-ism, of an influencer versus a movie star? You mentioned Bradley Cooper, for example, or Lady Gaga, who's now more and more movie star as much as a singer, versus, say, Marie Kondo or Joe Wicks. I mean, what's the comparative analysis, if you like, of their celebrity and influence?
Well, I think a lot of celebrities now only have niche appeal. There's a term for this, which is micro-celebrity, right?
Okay.
The idea that we no longer, or we have far fewer stars who unify a vast public. We talked at one point, I think, in a prior conversation about Tom Hanks and the fact that in the United States there was this incredible evening on television, March 12th, it was of 2020, when Donald Trump gets on TV and he says flights to Europe are going to be curtailed. He was actually wrong, but he announced this. And at the same time, Tom Hanks announced that he and his wife, Rita Wilson, had COVID. And CNN was in a frenzy. It didn't know which story was more important, and it just bounced between the two of them all evening. But that sense that someone like Tom Hanks, who is an old-school movie star in many respects, could show the country that COVID was going to affect it. He could do that, but a micro-celebrity couldn't, partly because they just don't speak to a kind of broad public in the way old-school movie stars do.
There is a sense of, as you're talking, I'm reflecting on the idea that when celebrities would come on line and say, I've had a bad day, or I'm feeling this way or that way, people go, well, do you know what? There's somebody over there who has a lot worse, a lot worse than you. So you can absolutely beat it with that thought, because you are out of touch, you're out of sync, and you've got this all out of context.
I think that's been a big part of the relatability crisis that I was alluding to before in the pandemic, because when certain celebrities tried to make quarantine videos, they got called out for their luxury quarantining. Jennifer Lopez is an early example of this. And so there's been one effect of the pandemic, which is to, I think, heighten, I'm speaking about the United States in particular, is to heighten a set of class relationships that normally don't get spoken of. And so I think that this kind of crisis that the pandemic represents on so many levels has also become a crisis for the celebrity economy. It's by no means the most important effect of the pandemic.
No.
I'm not suggesting that. But if somebody like me is an academic, if you accept my argument, which is that celebrity is a social phenomenon that we should take seriously, that tells us a lot about how we live, what our values are, what our interests are, then I think these things are important.
We found, because I present a talk, what you would call in America, a talk show in Ireland on a Friday night, and we have found that first of all, everyone wants Irish guests on the programme much more than any other. I don't know if that's just today or this at these days, but I don't think so. I think it was ever thus. But anyway, that's one thing. But certainly since COVID started, even though our show is a mixture of the serious and the lighter entertainment, when we cover COVID, and certainly at the beginning, the first 6 to 9 months, even the year, the demand from the public for the likes of Tony Houlihan, Luke O'Neill, people like this, they wanted to see them because there was trust and knowledge and explanation. And they became a strangely celebrity element to them.
Yeah, well, the new kind of scientist public authority is definitely a phenomenon that we have here in this country, and it overarches with the U.S. You know, Luke O'Neill, Tony Fauci, people like this.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that they have become the face of the pandemic in various ways, and it's probably not an accident that most of them are older white guys, right? And that they have access to a certain kind of traditional authority that maybe, we revert back to in times of crisis. In a certain way. I think what you said is so interesting, because I would draw a distinction between the Irish case and the U.S. case.
Mm.
I've suggested that in COVID has been very bad for the U.S. kind of celebrity marketplace by and large. But I don't think the same is true of Ireland. And in fact, you could talk about various cases. The Matt Damon case is clearly the headline here.
Yeah.
But, Adam King, certainly, as you know better than anybody, I think has through the Toy Show, has become that unifying figure. There are other examples that we could point to. I mean, I think that the Paul Mescal frenzy, which got commodified, the moment when we hear that Paul Mescal is attributing, is contributing to a 20% rise in sales of O'Neill shorts and, this kind of thing. So I think what I'm thinking about a lot just lately in this research, project is that the warning lights that I think celebrity culture is giving in the United States don't seem to be happening in Ireland the same way. And there are multiple cases here of that unifying pro-social celebrity that gives people in a country undergoing extraordinary difficulties a sense of being in something together.
And this person, whether it's, as you say, Adam King, or it's a bit of frippery with the Paul Mescal factor, but also the scientists kind of telling you where to go. Are they acting as a salve, or are people just scared, or have you delved that deep into it?
Well, here's the thing. thing I would say, if you go all the way back 100 years ago to the beginning of Hollywood in the silent period, the early studios had no desire or intention to market celebrities. But people wrote into the studios very early. I'm talking about, you know, 1908, very early. Mm-hmm. And they said, who's that woman that I saw in your film? And who is this guy? And the first celebrity is often considered to be a person called Florence Lawrence, not well remembered today. But Biograph, her studio, was really annoyed because people wrote in and said, who is this person? And they kind of had to name her. They wanted to call her the Biograph girl, but over time they had to call her Florence Lawrence. So I think that there is something about, you know, about the human nature, that we want personalization and focalization. We want to sort of feel as if we have relationships with people that we don't know. I think that that moment, that early unifying moment of 100 years ago, is now flipped around, and we're seeing kind of the reverse, that the niche celebrity landscape is so kind of fractured and broken down that it's showing us in some ways how imperiled, you might say, U.S. democracy is at this moment, how different the United States is, for example, than it was 100 years ago, where stars could serve this kind of centering function. Now it almost seems to happen in the reverse way.
And you can hear Professor Diane Negre speak to the Royal Irish Academy next month with an online lecture about celebrity and COVID. Just head over to ria.ie for more. With news of Big Brother star Nikki Graham's death this weekend, there's been a lot of discussion around mental health and eating disorders. On Liveline, Jo heard from Aoife regarding her desperate plea for help sent to her friends and their attempts to get her this help that she so badly needs. This discussion covers anorexia, bulimia and suicide, so please bear that in mind before listening.
I suppose it all kind of started off recently. The whole kind of campaign, I suppose I've had the eating disorder for about 12 years. But it just kind of, like, it's been severe for quite a number of years, but really kind of during the lockdown, particularly lockdown 3, it was just kind of one level too many for me, or one kind of factor too many, that it just kind of pushed me over the edge. And I kind of got to a point where I had just totally given up and attempted to take my own life. And then so I moved back in with family, and, you know, my family and friends were all there. They were all really supportive, and they were, you know, asking me, like, I suppose just to explain to them, like, really what it is that I kind of would experience day to day, and the things that I'm doing to myself, because eating disorders are very difficult to understand if you don't have them or have one. So I had written kind of a document, really, I suppose, that kind of just outlined the typical kind of day of the things that I would be doing to myself every day. And so I shared that with them. And then a friend put it up online anonymously, just to basically as a cry for help, just to say, you know, can anyone do anything? Like, we need to get her in somewhere, because, to be honest, I think this will kill me if I don't find a way to overcome it. And then from there on, you know, people have been, you know, getting in touch with that friend through Twitter, just saying, is there anything I can do? A few TDs have been in touch to say that they'll try their best, but there's no guarantees, really. So I've been kind of pretty much begging the mental health services for a long time to try and give me a bit more than kind of the typical outpatient kind of once a week therapy, because it just doesn't seem to work for me.
And Aoife, how long have you had a dysfunctional relationship with food?
I can think back to childhood, really. I didn't have an eating disorder in childhood, but I had a very dysfunctional relationship with food in childhood, and all throughout my teenage years, the kind of crash dieting, like, I was always very thin, I'm still very petite, but the crash dieting started when I was a teenager, and the starving and the kind of milkshake diets, all that kind of stuff, and then it kind of crossed the line into bulimia when I was kind of 18.
And you say that the pandemic, because of the fact that you're working at home or based at home, the pandemic can hide your dysfunctional relationship with food. Explain that.
I suppose, you know, it's been very severe now, you know, as I said, I've had it for about 12 years, but it's been very severe for about five of those years, the last 5 years. But, you know, I'd go into college or I'd go into work and you'd have the distraction of other people there to try and kind of, like, you know, they wouldn't know what was going on, of course, but just you know, I'd have moments throughout the day of, you know, just really getting to just feel and act like a normal person. But, you know, since working from home, it's just, it's taken it to a new level where it's very easy, it's much easier to kind of get away with all the things I'm doing. So it's basically 24/7 now of either eating everything and getting sick and taking laxatives or not eating anything. Just the constant kind of draw towards that form of self-harm as well. It's always there. So, you know, and I suppose that I'm working from home in my bedroom as well. So I'm in my bedroom, like I'm working, sleeping, eating, everything in my bedroom. So it's just hit a level that I didn't think it could really. I didn't think it could get worse before the lockdown, but it's just, it kind of set out.
Because you're at home, you can... And in one sense, you're not being observed or watched in that sense. You can order takeaways. You can order whatever food.
That's it. I'm averaging now about 3 takeaways a day on top of, several visits to shop. These are the days that I'm eating. Like, there's some days where I won't eat anything. But, on top of kind of, several visits then to the local shops, just, buying so much food I can barely carry it, and then kind of getting home, eating it all, so kind of I wouldn't even taste half of it, to be honest. It's just so furious, the kind of the pace at which I'm eating. It's I just can't stop, and then I'll eat until I literally feel like my stomach is just going to burst. Like, I can barely breathe sometimes, there's so much food in me. And then I'll force myself to get sick, and I'd be dizzy then, because, you know, it's a really horrible way to live. And that kind of has to, it's just constant at this point. Like, some days I'll start at 9 o'clock in the morning. Other days I'll be able to kind of push it off until about 11 or 12 in the day. But I'll still be there kind of 1 or 2 in the morning, still going. Or sometimes I'll get to sleep, and then if I wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning, it'll just start again. And to be honest, it's so bad at this point. I don't even feel like I'm doing it. I feel like I suppose the best way to describe it is that I'm kind of like a passenger in a car that's kind of going 200 kilometres down the motorway, and I can't stop it.
Aoife then went on to discuss the help she was getting and the help that she needs.
I've been kind of in and out of the mental health services, the outpatient ones, for years. Generally what happens is you're put on a waiting list to speak to a consultant, then you eventually... Mm-hmm. get to the consult, and you're speaking with kind of the consultant psychiatrist, and then you're put on a waiting list that usually is quite a good few months for outpatient treatment, and that's kind of like kind of an hour a week therapy. I've tried very hard to engage in outpatient therapy over the years, and I've worked with loads of different therapists. And the only way I can try to describe it is, you know, I'd be in the waiting room sometimes waiting to go in to see the psychiatrist or the psychologist, and I'd be eating in the waiting room and going then and getting sick in the toilets, and then going into my therapy session and then coming back out and just resuming, picking up where I left off. And with something like, I don't know if any of your listeners have read the document that I wrote, it's posted online, but when it's that severe, it's kind of, I'm just in a hurricane, and an hour a week, I just can't control it by myself. So I've spent hours in psychiatrist meetings and with psychologists, asking them, is there any way I can get into a residential facility just to help me just break the cycle? And they, for the last kind of since the beginning, they've always said, no, the HSE, we don't have public beds, that all the residential facilities are they're private. So what happened then was, about a year ago, I called one of these residential facilities just to ask, to basically beg them. I was kind of saying, look, I know you're private, but is there anything at all that you can do? Like, I'm going to die. And to be honest, Joe, there's a big part of me, I'd rather die than live through another minute of this, to be honest. But there is, you know, obviously there's a bit of a fight in me, which is why I'm doing all this now. But I was speaking with a clinical nurse in that residential facility, and she said all of the treatment centres in Ireland have 2 to 3 public beds that the HSE fund people to go into. And I was very upset, because I've lost count of the amount of times I've asked public psychiatrist to help get me in somewhere. So what happened then was I went to my consultant in Cork, my psychiatrist, and I said to him, look, I've been in touch with these treatment centres. I know there are beds. Can you please just help me to get in? And actually, the clinical nurse in the treatment centre said, I said, how can I get one of the beds? And she said, look, she said, I know it's not great, but she said the way it works is that it's the consultant that shouts about this and makes the best case for their patient. So I said to him, I said, look, will you please apply for this funding on my behalf from the HSE to get me in? And what he said was, he said, Lisa, looking at your history, you have a long history of engaging and disengaging. And he said, I don't think you're motivated enough to get for me to make that application for you, which, to be honest, Joe, was actually devastating to hear. Because, you know, sometimes the only motivation I can gather is to turn up to an appointment. Do you know what I mean? And for someone to sit there and say, I'm not going to advocate for you because I don't think you want the help.
Okay, well, we have to treat... We won't go into details about the actual consultations, but you're and you sound, Aoife, that description earlier on, that you're a passenger in the car and you're looking at what's happening to you, even though you're the driver, so to speak.
Yeah.
And but your analysis is so perceptive that it looks like you're almost hovering above yourself, looking down on yourself and saying, this is what I need to do, this is what I need, this is what I'm doing. Because you've incredible insight, it seems to me.
I suppose, like, I'm, 12 years at it now, and I generally do like to kind of try and take a step back and look at my own behaviours and my own thought patterns. But there's this kind of idea that awareness is in and of itself curative. But for me, I'm very aware. Like, I'm in no denial that the things I'm doing to myself are very harmful. But the awareness doesn't seem to help. I just can't stop. And it's just like living a completely secret life. It's like I've two lives, you know, so I'd be, you know, kind of binging and purging and stuff up in my room into like bags, actually. I have to resort to getting sick into bags, and then I'll go downstairs on a call to work and I'll be chatting away to colleagues as if nothing was wrong, and then the second the call ends, I'm just back at it again.
Aoife's story resonated with Joe's next caller, Roisin.
I'd be very much in the same boat. Like, I want to get better so badly. Like, I would, like, I remember somebody once said to me, I said, I don't really care if I die from this disease. Like, I'm so unhappy living this way. And she said, you don't want to die. You just don't want to continue living the way you're living now. And that's exactly how it feels. Like, I so badly want to get better and I want a life without this disease, but it feels impossible.
And when did your dysfunctional relationship with food begin, Roisin? I know I see in your text or your message, you're 21, Aoife is 30. When did your dysfunctional relationship with food begin, Roisin?
I was very similar to Aoife. Like, all throughout my life, I had a very dysfunctional relationship with food. Like, when I was 16, I was probably a little bit different because I was obese. And I always kind of binge ate in secret. I was very like secretive when it came to like my eating behaviors, and I always found it difficult to like put my knife and fork down when I was a child.
Okay. You were told to put your knife and fork down.
No, I found it difficult.
Oh, you found it difficult. Sorry, I thought you were being. Don't give me actual weights or anything like that, please. But would you have been very conscious of your weight?
Yeah, I was. Growing up, I was very self-conscious of how much I weighed. Like, I would have been teased about it, and I wasn't happy with myself from like a young age.
Yeah. And how long can you say that you've been suffering from an eating disorder?
I would say 5 years. Developed it when I was 16 after losing my nan. So.
And what effect has it had on your body since?
Similar to Aoife, I've lost teeth. The oral issues are quite hard. Like, I have a stomach condition now, and I get really bad like acid reflux and like sores on my mouth, and
obviously, like, loss of, like, a menstrual cycle and losing hair and joint pain. And I suffered seizures in the past.
Yeah. And we have a statement in from the HSE. Now, it's a long statement, but this is a quick presse of it, I'm told. The HSE said they aim to have 8 adult and 8 child adolescent teams available, but they only have 3 up and running. 2 child teen teams and 1 adult team. Have you been able to reach out for help, Roisin, and what's been the result?
Yeah, I've actually been in Lois Bridges twice.
Okay, that's the inpatient unit in Dublin, yeah.
It's private, isn't it? Yeah. So I was there under, like, my healthcare, like, layoff.
Okay.
So you only get a certain amount of time. And right. I don't really believe that there's a certain amount of days that a person can, like it's like this pressure to recover really fast. It doesn't work that way. So I've been able to reach out for help, but, like, as Aoife said, like, when you're getting 1 hour a week and, like, your behaviours are consuming your whole day and they're so out of control, it's kind of like watching a train wreck and you're going to these, like, appointments and you're still engaging behaviours and you don't really have the cognition to kind of engage properly because you're so focused on, like, you know, being malnourished, like, not feeling well.
I know it's a difficult question and shouldn't really be asked of you, but what help do you think would make a difference, Roisin?
To be quite honest, I think that's the issue. Like, I don't really have an answer for myself or for anybody else. I've been unsuccessful in inpatient in the past.
So far. Whereas Aoife believes she does need inpatient treatment to try and break the cycle.
Mm-hmm. And the women had a lot more than their condition in common.
Aoife, did you mention, are you studying psychology?
I did.
You did? And Roisin, what are you studying?
Psychology.
Okay. Why are you laughing, Roisin?
This is ironic. Yeah, it is. Joe, can I just reminded me of, you know, with even the whole psychology thing. So
yeah.
I remember one time I was, again, referred back into the services and the waiting list for outpatient treatment was so long that my consultant asked me, she said, oh, look, you've done psychology. She said, can you give therapy to yourself? And I actually was just in disbelief. This was a consultant psychiatrist asking someone crying out for help, like a service user, if they could give themselves therapy because the resources weren't there for them to do it. And that kind of, for me, kind of sums up how under-resourced the services are.
Yeah, and I would have thought, and Roisin, come in on this, please. I would have thought with a balance, they say, inter alia, they're saying there's 3.94 million unspent remains fully available to invest in specialist ED posts. Now, have either of you participated in research? Has anyone?
I have.
Who's that, Roisin?
Yeah, I've done like a bit of research when I was living in London.
You did it yourself?
No, Ona was, and I participated in like
research
other people were doing.
And what was that like, Roisin? Was that at all helpful or?
Well, not necessarily. Like, for me, I didn't really get anything out of it. But in terms of, like, applying, like my own experience, like having that maybe help somebody else.
That's a brilliant way to look at it.
I also kind of think that it's important that, like, specialists are more aware of, like, atypical eating disorder behaviours because they're usually the most dangerous ones.
Okay.
And so, like, if that helps, like, a professional maybe, like, be more aware of, like, a behaviour they wouldn't have known about before, like, I'm happy to kind of give that, like, help.
But I'm just coming off the back of both of you saying, both of you have are studying, well, Aoife's obviously, you've graduated in psychology, have you, Aoife? Is Aoife there? I think she has. I think she actually has a PhD. And Roisin, you're studying.
Joe, I'm here. Yeah. Sorry, the line cut out there.
Okay, you graduated in psychology.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And did you do a PhD?
I did, yeah.
In what?
Psychology.
No, but in what aspect of it?
Oh, mine was, so it was a research PhD. It wasn't clinical psychology, so it wasn't around kind of like mental health or anything. It was more kind of human personality.
And
really,
behaviour and all that. Yeah. Okay. And do you find, Aoife and Roisin, do you find talking about it like this, or sorry, generally, forget about like this, as if, do you find talking about it at all helpful, Aoife?
For me, I suppose sometimes it's such a lonely world, and it is my whole world. So every now and then, just kind of saying to somebody like, this is what I'm doing to myself, is a bit cathartic. But generally, no, because the things that I do to myself are so severe sometimes that I think people, it just makes people feel powerless and helpless. So yeah. I then feel, sure, look, why would I share it if no one can do anything? But it's a really lonely world when it's just you and you're doing all these things and you don't know how to stop it yourself.
But it's not just you.
Yeah, that's it.
And Roisin, the same question to you.
I think I feel a bit like almost crazy when I tell people what I go through, because they kind of look at me like, why would you do that? My logical mind sometimes is like, oh, why would I do that to myself? But I don't find talking about it helps, because it's a bizarre way of living when you think about it.
Yeah.
And there's no way to really, for other people to make sense of it. And they can't, like, they, I know that a lot of people, like, they, like, I have an amazing support system, like an incredible,
great,
family and friends are amazing, but like they can't, there's so much of this disease that there's so much secrecy. It's hard to be fully honest as well, because there's so much shame around it.
But for both women, speaking out has given them a much needed focus.
Like the fight seems to be back, which I had totally, the fight was just gone completely. And it's just given me something to really kind of throw everything into. I don't know if it will work. I don't know if I'll ever get better. I don't know if I'll survive it, to be honest. But it's something anyway, it's just something to focus on.
You're educating so many people today, and Roisin as well. Roisin, how do you feel when you hear Aoife say that she had the passion she has at the moment? And it's really important, they say. I was reading psychiatrist Brendan Keddie's book at the weekend, and that's one of the things he said, try and be passionate, and just strikes me. And Roisin, is it the same for you? Have you, when you wake up in the morning, what's your feeling?
I would be kind of similar to Aoife recently. It's actually funny, because I was really struggling throughout like the winter months of the pandemic and stuff. I think with the kind of hope of the nights getting longer and that has a significant impact on my mood and my motivation. I've realised that there's going to be a time past this where I can spend time with my family and my friends, and I want that for myself. I think my fight is back, definitely.
That was today's Liveline, and for help and support information, visit rte.ie/support. That's it for today. Thanks for listening.